Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. So, shout out to the ladies over in Bing for finding another bug to stare at me during the show. That's awesome. I love that. So, yeah, that's a pretty cool picture. And Gov, how's it going? Doing well?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad.
All right. So let's get started today. From Brian, I'm planning on upgrading my XP laptop to Windows 8 when it's released later this month. In the meantime, I wanted to tinker with some Windows 8 development. I'm not an MSDN subscriber, so I installed the eval version of Windows 8 on a second hard drive, a new SSD. I understand that there isn't an upgrade path from the evaluation license, so this was just temporary. When Windows 8 is released, I want to upgrade my XP install, but I also want it on new SSD. What's the best way to go about this? Thanks for the great show. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, we had a email back and forth trying to figure out, like, I heard XP laptop, and it's like, wow, how old is this thing?
Yeah.
But actually, it turned out it's not very old at all. It was a Core 2 Duo, I believe, so with 2 gig of RAM, so it was perfectly capable. The ideal case in here is to just pull out the drive, throw in the SSD, install Windows 8, copy the data from the XP partition. Don't try to do an upgrade because you can't do a true upgrade from XP to Windows 8 anyways.
Yeah.
And you want to do the install fresh on the SSD. You don't want to try to copy an image or anything like that. You want Windows 8 to set up knowing that it's on an SSD.
Yeah.
And that's truly the easiest way of doing it.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Next one from Pete. I'm building a machine with Windows 8 and had replaced a hard drive with an SSD. I installed Windows 8 from a thumb drive. But every time I boot the machine, I had to quickly press F12 to call up the menu so I could pick the Windows UEFI boot manager as the boot mechanism. The default legacy was not bootable, so I would get a modern version of the insert system disk on every boot. There's no way to turn off UEFI on the Lenovo A720 BIOS. Let's talk a little bit about UEFI and what users should know here.
Yeah, so UEFI is not anything new, per se. It's been around technically, I think, since 2000, although it just hasn't been adopted very heavily until, Windows 7 X64.
And for people who might not know, what is UEFI?
Universal Extendable Firmware Interface, I believe.
That's nice, too, but can you say what it actually is in
layman's way? Okay, so you want yeah. something that's actually understandable by our end users.
Yeah.
UEFI, or just EFI in general, is the evolution to BIOS.
Yeah.
The BIOS was very limited, text-based, very small amount of memory in order to have all of its code. The EFI interface is significantly expandable. It cuts out a lot of the legacy that has just been around in PCs for the past 30 years.
So in old BIOS systems, BIOS was something that you went into.
Mm-hmm.
Is EFI something that you go into? Is there a configuration menu when you boot?
You can boot into EFI as well when you're starting up the PC. Nice thing about EFI is it also has programmatic interfaces that the OS can interact with. The OS did interact with BIOSes as well, but not to the same extent that it can with EFI.
Mm-hmm.
And the main issue that he found when installing the Windows 8 is that he used a USB thumb drive.
Yeah.
Now, that is actually the way for installing with UEFI. The system recognized, hey, I'm installing this particular manner. The motherboard is EFI capable. I'm going to install in an EFI capable manner. So that's why he sees this new boot menu, which is, again, only something you'd ever see with an EFI-based system. Now, what he can do is actually disable the BIOS-based portion of the system. He might have something called a CSP. It's kind of a compatibility layer mm-hmm. that the BIOS has, so it exposes a compatible BIOS layer to the system. It's one of these hybrid boards.
Yeah.
So what he could be able to do, I don't know anything specific about his system, is go in, disable legacy BIOS support, change the boot order, and only boot into the EFI.
Yeah.
And that would be what I would recommend. I would also recommend, if he hadn't done it already, to upgrade the EFI or the BIOS. Even when you're talking about EFI-based systems, the motherboard manufacturers and the PC OEMs talk about updating the BIOS.
So it's like updating the firmware on BIOS.
Exactly.
So
you want to go to the latest one.
Okay, cool. All right. All right, next from Eddie. He says, hi, not too long ago you said I'd try the following update. It's a KB 258-1464 to increase the transfer speed of my USB external hard drive. I wanted to do that now, but when I read the KB, I saw the following statement. Note, for some USB storage devices, performance can be improved if the maximum transfer size is increased from the default 64K. This update supports a change when the hardware size is increased from the default 64K. This update supports a change when the hardware vendor provides a INF to set the value for the USB storage devices. So Eddie says, I didn't find any INF file on the hard drive itself, even when unchecking hide protected operating system files checkbox. But when I searched in the registry, even before I installed the hotfix, I could see under the vendor ID of Western Digital, my hard drive's vendor, a key called maximum transfer length. Does its presence mean that the hard drive supports this kind of manipulation, and do I only need to change its value to make it work, or is there something additional? By the way, the value in there is set to 1 meg, but after I hear from you, I'll still try to set it to 2 meg if there's an improvement.
You don't want to mess with that particular key, you know, something that the device manufacturer set. Go ahead and install the hotfix, and it may take advantage of it.
Yeah.
But don't try to increase it to 2 meg because it may not support it anyways.
Yeah.
Or it might not support it properly, which is why they set it to 1 meg. Install the hotfix. You can go above the 64, but keep it between the 64 and the 1 meg for that drive.
Okay. Cool. All right. Next question. Can I install an operating system on my RAM? All right. So... That's the long and short of that question.
I was actually expecting a little bit more.
No, that was it. I would say yes, you can buy an SSD. That's my snarky way of of answering that one. The other one, too, you could run a VM off of a RAM disk, which is kind of...
It's similar, right? I've seen PCI, originally ISA-based, then PCI-based, then PCIe-based. Daughter carts that just has sticks of RAM in it.
Yeah.
You can buy one of those. Oddly enough, they're not too terribly expensive.
Not now.
They used to be. I mean, I remember 1 gig
back
RAM.
In the day, this was what we were expecting for SSDs. We
thought
it was going to be these boards with tons of RAM on them.
And a battery backup.
Yeah.
So yes, technically you can do it.
So I'm going to project myself into this question and think that they probably just want a fast system.
Yeah, in which case the SSD is the right way to go.
Yeah, and the pitfalls of trying to run an OS off your RAM would be if that thing crashes for whatever reason...
You're SOL.
Yeah, you're kind of just trashed. And it's just... probably not the best method to have a fast system.
What's interesting is that, you know, you install an operating system in RAM.
Yeah.
The system itself still needs a paging file.
Yeah.
Right? If you put that paging file anywhere other than disk, what you're telling the memory manager to do is to emulate RAM that's in an emulated disk in RAM.
Yeah.
Which is... sort of defeating of the purpose of what the memory manager actually does.
Yeah.
I've only ever seen systems that actually have to be installed in RAM under very, very specialized circumstances.
Yeah.
And none of which I've ever seen in a home user.
Okay. All right. From Rob, greetings from Toronto. Hello, Toronto. I have only listened to a handful of your podcasts. Come on, watch a video. You're missing. But I do appreciate the thoughtful and detailed answers provided. I have a puzzle for you and would appreciate some ideas on how to track down the problem or some background on what's going on. We're a small office under 50 computers with a mix of XP, Windows Server 2008, Server 2008 R2, and Windows 7. Occasionally, when you file copy a large file like a VHD in Windows Explorer or X-copy from Windows 7 computer on a file server, to a file server, the Windows 7 copy process will hang. You cannot end the task on the process. If you try, the end task will last until you reboot. What seems to help was running netsh, int tcp set global auto tuning level equal disabled. What is the process hanging occurring? Is it a good idea to disable auto tuning? And you had some back and forth on this, so what was the end result on that?
Disabling autotune is something that got introduced in Vista in order to help map out the best way to transfer packets across an Ethernet network and an IP network.
Yeah.
Now, normally disabling it should not help anything.
Yeah.
But in his current infrastructure, it could, based on, you know, the various switches that are involved. I mean, auto-tuning in general was designed for home users, simple networks that don't have managed switches or that whose managed switches are configured properly.
Yeah.
Those were particularly old switches, but we also got into the fact that they're running just regular Cat 5 Ethernet cable.
Yeah, so it was Cat 6 in the server room, but it was Cat 5
in
the rest
areas
of the
where they were potentially having problems.
Yeah.
So now Cat 5 is not actually designed to go gigabit. Mm-hmm. You know, you want Cat 5e or Cat 6 in order to go gigabit. So something that you can try is setting it to 100 meg per second full duplex, and you might actually help performance in that case as opposed to turning off the auto tuning.
Cool. Okay.
I don't believe that we've gotten a response back on whether or not that has worked.
Okay. Well, let us know, and I can't wait to hear. All right, next question. I've got two monitors, and when I play a full-screen game on my primary monitor, the second monitor is still the Windows desktop. How can I black out the second monitor so it doesn't show anything at all? My graphics card is from ATI. I'm running Windows 7. I don't know if this makes a difference. However, any solution will do. For instance, is there a Teeny app that I can run to disable a second monitor for a while? I'd rather not open the Windows display settings every time I run a game, disable the monitor that way. Yeah, there is a simple way to do this. It's called Windows P. So hit Windows P is the Teeny app to turn off that other monitor. When you hit Windows P, you can just select PC screen only, and it'll do just that. It'll just show on the one PC screen, and then you won't have to worry about it. And then when you finish a game, Windows P again, and do the extended desktop. So you don't have to go into display settings anymore, and that's since Windows 7.
Oh, even Vista.
Vista, yes, you are correct, sir.
I know
ding,
everybody
ding.
Likes yeah. to ignore Vista, but you know the poor stepchild.
All right, my mind is playing a violin for you. All right, so next question from Devin. Hey, Gove and Larry, love the show. I'm upgrading to a new laptop. Old one was an HP ProBook 6560B with Windows 7 32-bit, and the new one is a HP EliteBook 8570P. 64-bit. I have some batch files and other programs that will not run properly on Windows 7 64-bit unless I right-click and choose Run as Admin. I checked the UAC settings, and they're the same on both PCs, and none of the programs are set for compatibility mode on either PC. One example is I created a batch file to check the uptime of a user's PC. On my old PC, Windows 7 32-bit, I could double-click to open it and enter the PC I wanted to check on the uptime, and it would run with no problem. On the new PC, Windows 7 64-bit, I run the same batch file and enter the same PC to check as I did on my old system. When I press enter to run the command, I get a message that says uptime exe is not recognized as an internal or external command. If I right-click and run as admin on the Windows 7 64-bit, then I'll run okay. I can't seem to find why these run differently on both systems when all permissions are the same. Any help is greatly appreciated.
We went again back and forth on this one, and it turns out that it's differences in the path statement. What you can do in order to fix this kind of thing is use explicit paths to uptime, so you pointed it directly at wherever uptime exists as opposed to just assuming that it's in the path. So rewrite the batch files to give explicit paths. That's fundamentally the best way of doing it as opposed to relying on having existed in a particular area of the file system.
Okay. Well, that's kind of easy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There you go.
Well, that and batch files... You know, get away from that. Go to PowerShell.
Yeah. All right. From Philip, first off, what's with the new punchline at the beginning of the show? It's not as cool as the old one. Go.
It was a one-time only thing.
Go. You got to stick, dude. Have I ever said anything other than deep inside the Death Star? No. No, I stick. I like Jerry Maguire. This is what I do. All right. But yeah, don't worry. I'll take care of that.
He'll beat me into submission.
I inherited an old Access database file, 2003 MDB with MDW, and was asked by the company to find a way to recover the data in it. The old administrator was removed from the company, but before he left, he removed every user except his from the file. We don't have a way to get a hold of him, find out what his password was. Is there a way to get back into the database file? I'm the domain and enterprise admin on the domain controller, and if required, I can receive access to the local administrator account on the domain controller server. In SQL, there's always a way to get in, but I'm not as familiar with this type of situation as it pertains to Access 2003.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate. This particular problem has nothing to do with NTFS permissions or AD permissions or anything that at this point in time you have in control. This is internal security to the Access database itself.
It's this not is like someone SQL. Flipping a drive secure or a job security switch.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
There are numerous third-party utilities out there that will attempt to recover the password in the Access database. Unfortunately, there's nothing for Microsoft that we can provide.
Yeah.
But again, there's numerous utilities out there, all reasonably priced, depending on how important that database is.
Yeah. Okay. All right, there you go. From Golnaz, our own Golnaz studio operator, said, Adobe On Location crashes in the middle of doing screen captures. Happens on 4 different machines. All have the latest updates for Adobe CS5. So we looked into this and found that in the log files, the graphics driver was crashing throughout the day. And we have 4 machines here that capture from all the cameras and the screen capture. And they kept crashing. And so just updated the ATI, the latest driver, and we were good. So...
It's one of those things, like, you know, it's difficult to always keep on track of what updates are required, but you really should go through, you know, every month or so. Like, I wouldn't go as draconian as every day or every week because you don't have a whole lot of time to spend on that. But go and check for, you know, critical updates, not necessarily saying, you know, you have to update every possible thing. If you don't have an issue, then don't update the driver, right?
Yeah, don't. Fix it if it's not broken.
Exactly. But if you're thinking of upgrading your machine, that's the time before you upgrade, is to actually do go through and update everything that you can.
Yeah.
And then test it for a couple of days afterwards, right? Update smartly. Don't update across the board all at once and then hope everything will just be perfect right afterwards.
Yeah.
Update, test it out for a few hours a day, whatever. Update the next thing. You know, use a phased approach. Be smart about it.
Yeah, and this was one where we had updated Adobe CS5.
Because it was the one that was crashing.
Yeah, because we thought, well, you know, that's going to be the problem because it's crashing. It must be some kind of update. We should try that. Did all the updates for Windows and still had the problem. And just didn't think, you know, well, you know, the graphics driver, it's using a lot of the resources from the card anyway. So that ended up fixing the problem. So...
Well, it's kind of funny. We keep forgetting that processes, applications are not as compartmentalized as they used to be. You know, they are using not just the OS, but the third-party drivers. Third-party drivers load in its process. So starting with Vista, with the new graphics model, there is a user mode portion, DLL, that's loaded into the process that is not like it was before, where... It was just a kernel mode driver, and if something went wrong, you bug checked.
Yeah.
Now it's, you know, a user mode portion, and if something goes wrong, you just take out the process. But it often makes diagnosing the actual issue harder, or at least not as self-contained to what you'd think it would be.
Yeah.
So things like codecs, device drivers, USB drivers, you know, if you have a weird device that is attached to your system, that could be loading a DLL into your process. There are a lot more factors nowadays of what can crash a process.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, was it was a case where we just didn't think to go into the logs at first, too. But once we went in there, we saw these ATI crashes throughout the day, and that's pretty self-explanatory what you need to do there. All right, next question from Dave. In Windows 7, is there a way to configure Windows updates to apply the latest security changes our security updates closer in time to when the updates are released, preferably within a couple of hours? Windows update settings offer a daily at 3 a.m. option, but it seems like Windows 7 machines are not prompting to install updates until the Wednesday or Thursday after the Tuesday security update releases. Curious related questions. Are Tuesday security update releases always released at the same time on Tuesday, i.e. 2 p.m. Pacific time?
So the first part of the question... There is no specific way to force it as soon as it's available to the machine, because we'll actually do a phased approach on how we do updates.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for the critical security ones, but for other updates, not everybody across the entire planet gets it all at the exact same time.
Yeah.
But what you can do if you're in an enterprise environment is our Windows software update service, WSAS servers, can take updates from, you know, our critical updates, force them down on the machine, and yes, trigger the reboot within 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Which would be my recommendation if you truly do want that. As for our critical updates, do we release it at the exact same time on every single Tuesday? That's a good question. I don't want to go necessarily on record saying yes, that will happen all the time, but
yeah,
we do strive for a particular time on Tuesday in order for all of our partners, in order for the world to be ready for that time. You know, we want to be predictable.
Yeah. Okay, cool. From Samyang, nice show. I keep getting spam from a company that I won't name. Every time I block it with quote companyname.com, is the email, I block it with quote companyname.com. Is the email really coming from this company? How do I find out the real domain of the email in Outlook 2010? Because apparently that didn't stop it. So, how you look at the header?
You look at the header. You can just right click on the email, check out the properties, and you can see where it's coming from. They've probably just spoofed the return address.
Yeah, and it might be a service that they're using too, which is why it might not be blocking it. But one of the things I'd try, because the company they named is a fairly, you know, it's a big company that I've used several times, just use the unsubscribe from the bottom of the email. And I know a lot of times I always think, wow, they're just going to know I'm a person now because I use that, and then they'll really start spamming me. But I've gone through my email a couple times in the last year and just done unsubscribe on every email that I see in there that I don't want, and it's pretty effective. I mean, the last two times I did it, I thought my email was broken for a while after because I just
getting
email, and I thought it must have, like, you know, I screwed up my account. But so that would work. The other thing that you could do too is if you can set a server rule to just block everything that mentions that company name in your email, you could just send that to your junk folder. Of course, if you're using your typical POP client where you've got Outlook at home or some other mail client, it's better to set it on the server so that you're not getting it on your phone still too.
Right.
But yeah, that's one option for you. But the other is look at the details and look at the header. So that's about all you can do.
This is one of those times where, I don't know if you do it, but I do it. I have particular emails that I create for spam.
Yeah.
And I seem to recall you and your domain, and you do that.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that the other night because I did the same thing. So, you know, I have my own URL, greengem.com, and I get any email that goes to that. And so, like, if I'm, you know, I sign up for Ford Sync to register my sync, I use FordSync at greengem.com, and I know I'm going to get that email no matter what. And if I start getting spam, I know who the offender was.
Right.
So it's really nice. I just love that practice. All right, there you go. Pick of the week time. Pick of the week, and we got good ones this week, awesome ones. The first one, let's go with CNET, Windows 8 PCs. So this is the complete list of new PC launch list. So
as of the 12th.
As of the 12th. So, or according to CNET, I should say, too, because I haven't seen this from us. But this is an interesting list of new PCs coming out. You definitely want to look through this. I don't know if it is a complete list or not, but I really enjoyed looking through this list this morning. Lots of cool stuff here. There's a Dell with the screen that flips over. Very cool. There's the Yoga up above that, which the Yoga I'm really leaning towards. I think I'm going to be a Surface Pro guy, but I don't know. That Yoga, it speaks to me. HP, of course. There's some nice HP machines here. And what do we got there? Lenovo. There's some killer Lenovo PCs. I heard someone talking about one the other day that just sounded incredible. And Samsung, of course, solid hardware out of Samsung.
The Ativ, yeah.
And then we got the Sonys here. Sony is in the game. Look at that.
The really cool thing about the Sonys, and I haven't done the in-depth review about all the other ones, but what I can say about the Sony is that they have a machine with full HD 1080p in a 10.1-inch display, which is just
sweet,
phenomenal right there.
Nice. Awesome. So, yeah, I can't wait to get my hands on all these machines.
Or maybe that's the Duo will
try them all out. But yeah, there you go. Lots of touch machines, lots of all kinds of different hardware there. So, yeah, run through it, check it out, see what you think. Love to hear your comments on the Windows 8 machines that you love and which ones you think are awesome. I'm going to be pounding on as many of these machines as I can get my hands on.
So. Yeah, and you know, for the people out there, go talk to the vendors and, you know, get them to put what you guys want in it, right?
Yeah.
Like, maybe you want machines with NFC. Maybe you want machines with more sensors built in, you know. We need customer demand for, you know, new and exciting PCs and PC-like form factors. You know, we have these convertibles. You know, they're tablets. They plug into a keyboard. You know, one of the things that we talked about was a keyboard with the battery in it to extend it, right? Some of them are like that.
Yeah.
You know, that is super cool. And that's, you know, coming from customer feedback of what people want. So
we should do a holiday show where we go through and pick some of our favorite machines and
absolutely.
Do like a bulleted item that tells what each machine has that we really
maybe
like.
Maybe even for the type of customer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You can
exactly.
actually say what's your best bet if you're a home user, if you're a home user on the go. You know, a lot of times you don't need something that is super duper light if you're just on the couch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so for me, one of the things that would be mandatory in a new machine with anything mobile like a laptop would be touch. I'm just not going to get anything that doesn't have touch at this point. I think we kind of crossed a threshold there. The other thing is NFC, and most people would say, well, NFC isn't really adopted. It's not, well, I wouldn't say it's not adopted, but it's not widely used yet.
Yet
is the key word, and there's tons of really cool stuff that I think people... Once they realize that NFC is more than just paying for Starbucks, there's lots of use cases where when they start using that, it's going to just change everything.
Mm-hmm.
So can't wait to see that. So next pick of the week, MSR, the integrated UIs. So this is kind of cool. This is some of the research work being done out of the Cambridge MSR. And it's how to do hand tracking and detailed tracking of where your fingers are with some devices on your wrists. And it looks kind of like a Spider-Man gimmick here. there better be a Spider-Man game if they come out with this, because that would be awesome. This is, you know, of course it's not going to be like that.
No, it'll always be smaller. This is just a prototype.
Yeah, it's funny if... I guess you have to be a Microsoft employee to get to see this side of MSR, but if you're ever over there and you go into like Benko's office or something, I mean, they're putting this stuff together. They're coming up with this on the fly, and so a lot of the hardware looks like this. It's
it's like a mad scientist room, right?
It's like Clint Ruckus on steroids, which is a very disturbing thought. So this is one of the things they can do, and you can watch the video about... you know, how they do hand movements and stuff like that, and all the different things they can pick up. And it's kind of cool. You could use it for like body tracking in a movie, or you could use it for a video game or all kinds of different things. So very cool. And then finally, the last pick of the week. My favorite game in the entire world, XCOM, Enemy Unknown. So this was a game that came out 20 years ago. And it came out, it was a DOS game when it originally came out. And some of you kids might have seen XCOM on lists of like best games of all time and wondered, what's that game? Well, here it is. They've redone this game. And, you know, this game has been updated a couple of different times. They made like a first-person shooter out of it. They made some like real-time, people were not thrilled with the gameplay on the sequels and the games that followed XCOM Enemy Unknown. This is a complete recreation of the original game with better graphics and a couple other enhanced things that just make the gameplay really cool. The game is kind of hard to explain. It's like a business simulator for the most part, because you're kind of running a company and you're trying to keep aliens from invading the Earth and taking over the Earth. And so in that sense, it's kind of like, you know, running the Men in Black program. And it was kind of cool because 20 years ago when this came out, it came out like right after the X-Files too. So there's a lot of interest in that. And then when you actually shoot down a UFO, you send a team of people there, and that's where it turns into like this kind of turn-based. Well, the whole game is turn-based, but it's like a game of chess. So it's just an incredible game to play. I've already put too many hours into this game. It's starting to impact my sleep schedule, But it's a kind of game where you'll play one game for, like, you know, days on end.
Which is kind of cool. Like, I'm not a twitchy kind of gamer. You know,
yeah.
I don't play FPSs very well.
Yeah.
The real-time strategy is, you know, similar to this, but it's also pretty twitchy.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're playing, I'm just going to, like, throw out, like, Age of Empires 2 or something, because that was the last one with Wallace that I really enjoyed. But you're moving as fast as you can. You're trying to upgrade everything as fast as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. Because this is turn-based, you know, you run it on a PC off to the side, and I'll play a couple of rounds, and then I'll go back doing something else. I'll come back, play a couple rounds. If someone walks in the room, you're not, like, frantically trying to find the pause button and stuff like that. It's just a laid-back, relaxed kind of game that you can play while sitting on your couch with a mouse, because you don't need anything other than a mouse to play this game to begin with. So it's the kind of game, run it on your screen at home, on your TV, mm-hmm. just sit back on your couch with the mouse, and very enjoyable. I'm just absolutely thrilled that this game came out. And I'm the thing that I'm most excited about is it is the old game, only redone better. So kudos to these folks, and I just can't say enough good about the game.
I want it touch-enabled. Let's get
yes,
rid of the mouse.
Exactly. So I talked to him about this, because I wanted to run it on a touch machine that I have, mm-hmm. Figuring, well, I'll just, you know, swipe, it would be perfect. And, like, the base menu where you're looking at the base, it looks kind of like the modern UI start screen on Windows 8. So it would be perfect for touch. And they're like, yeah, we don't really support touch. And truth be told, I played it on this Samsung here, and it was pretty cool with the stylus, because it's kind of right mouse dependent. You use the right mouse button a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that with the stylus on the Samsung. But it's not the greatest experience. It's something that I think they would have to kind of support that to make it a better experience for that. And I hope they do, because it would just be an incredible touch game.
Well, it looks cool. I'm going to have to download the demo.
Yeah, there you go, XTOM.com. It's available on Steam, Xbox, PlayStation, and you can get it now. It's available now. So that's the show for this week. If you want to write us, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com, or you can leave comments in the show notes, and we'll get back to you there. We prefer the email so that we can go back and forth with you. And that's the show for this week. See you next week.